49-year-old Joe Finkel of Fairbanks and North Pole resident Charlie Adams died when their plane crashed Friday evening. They were on a father and son camping trip in the Brooks Range. The rest of the group waited on a lake while the two left in the plane to look for caribou. Investigators can't say what caused the single engine mall to crash near the Niger River in the gates of the Arctic National Park. A pilot flying out of Bettles saw the crash site Saturday afternoon. North Slope Borough Safety Officer Jim Beckham says search and rescue crews may get there today.
It's possible. I've been talking with the chief pilot of our search and rescue operation, and currently they're involved in a search of lost hunters at this time. I'm not sure just exactly when we're going to be able to get into the site.
So far, weather has thwarted efforts to get to the wreckage. Finkel was a manager for Totem Ocean Trailer Express, and Adams worked for Frontier Flying Service. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bachman.
3, 2, 1. Part of the reason you're hearing this report is because tiny iron particles on the audio tape are locked into patterns as they pass the magnetized record head. Scientists now know something similar occurs on the ocean floor. Iron particles in the magma welling up align themselves to the Earth's magnetic field as they cool. But years ago, when scientists passed a magnetic reading instrument along those patterns, they learned our magnetic North Pole and South Pole have frequently flipped places. Professor Paul Lehrer studies ancient rock.
We only have a very good record of the reverses of the field for the past 150 million years or so, and they're fairly frequent in that time span, although they don't occur at regular intervals, and there are very long spans of time when they do not reverse, or the field is of one polarity. Back beyond that time, we really don't have any idea of the frequency or the number of reverses that have occurred. We really only have spot readings in time of a particular polarity or reversal.
Now, Lehrer, a UAF geology professor, and two colleagues report discovering a new spot on the record over 3 billion years old, by far the oldest sign of this puzzling flip-flop. They found it in a large rock formation called a pluton in South Africa. Created over 3.2 billion years ago, the pluton lay hidden in the crust while taking millions of years to cool.
Most of these bodies that do cool, even in more recent times, do not seem to record these flips very well. Occasionally they do. So again, it's sort of fortuitous if you happen to have one that's cooling during the timing of a reversal. Many things are just simply cool in a period of a single polarity.
The age of Lehrer's rock is raising a few eyebrows in scientific circles. While models of Earth's formation in early history predict a magnetic field forming as early as 4 billion years ago, many geologists doubt the chance of reading an unblemished history in rocks that old. That's because the chances of these ancient rocks getting reheated in geological activity are pretty good. And when reheated to certain temperatures, the iron particles in rocks realign to the existing magnetic field.
Well, of course it's possible that there was reheating, but through the use of various dating techniques here at the University of Alaska, dating of different minerals, we were able to construct a cooling history for that pluton that indicated that it did not undergo any significant reheating from that cooling at about 2.2 billion years ago.
Still, Lehrer admits the fuzziness in some of the data, but hopes that his discovery will now prompt other geologists to look for paleomagnetism where few looked before. Fellow UAF geologist David Stone is also an authority on the subject. He thinks Lehrer's discovery helps fill in the picture of Earth's early history. But Stone says scientists don't have a definitive answer to why our planet flips its magnetic pole.
No, there was just an observation. They do take place, and they take place irregularly, and as Paul pointed out, we have a fairly complete record for the last 150-odd million years, and a very good record for the last 10 million years or so. But they, other than the fact that the field spends almost exactly half its time in each polarity, there doesn't seem to be any pattern to the way in which it reverses.
Stone says one of the hotter debates taking place in geology today is what happens when the Earth's magnetic field flips. Some scientists believe the poles wander along the Earth until they're upside down. Other geologists say the field goes to zero and then has a 50-50 chance of coming upside down or right side up.
In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Three, two, one. When Congress pulled the plug on much of NASA's funding, many of the agency's space missions stalled and faltered. But growing concerns about global warming and the ozone hole has found a new target for the sophisticated equipment meant to study stars, planets, and deep space. That target? Our own planet. University of Alaska Fairbanks scientist Knut Stamnik organized the International Radiation Symposium taking place in Fairbanks this week. He says huge computer models of our weather system are trying to simulate global warming scenarios. Unfortunately, the models haven't successfully mimicked clouds. Since the sun's energy drives Earth's climate, the researchers are using their instruments now to calculate how much solar energy clouds absorb.
Without clouds, several models seem to give similar results. Once people incorporate clouds, these models diverge. So they give very different results. So you don't know how to do the clouds correctly. But that situation is now improving.
Changing because new data gleaned from images taken in the infrared or ultraviolet ends of the light spectrum are improving scientists' understanding of weather. Compared to these scientists, meteorologist Ted Fathauer says he feels like a floor trader on the stock exchange.
I'm interested in short-term fluctuations and in reporting them to our clients, namely the American public. The goal of researchers is to look at longer-term economic trends, and they're looking at what happens over a period, say, of 50 years as opposed to 50 hours.
Fathauer says while the high-tech gear these scientists use won't help his forecasting today or tomorrow, he thinks the research will pay off in the long term. More than 360 scientists meeting at UAF wrap up the symposium this weekend. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
I'm standing on Main Street, Calcutta, in front of the historic Fairview Inn, holding Jim Gleason's fine art print, Calcutta Reflections, in my hand. The scene is Main Street, Calcutta, circa 1976. It's after a heavy rain, and all the potholes and the low spots on the shoulders lie placidly, full of water like little lakes reflecting the sky above and the signs and buildings along Main Street. It's a scene of silent and sparkling, creating a kaleidoscope of roof angles, signposts, trees, and clouds. It's a scene that is, as of today, gone. We've been paid. 12 feet of black, shiny new asphalt caps the dusty gray line of the original Main Street by some industrial ice cream sandwich. Its faded yellow stripes barely visible, even in the bright August sun. I'm here with Brad Alt, the operations and maintenance for the Mat 3 Borough. And Brad, can you tell us a little bit how this project to pave the shoulders of Main Street came about and what was the impetus behind it?
There was a number of factors that we were looking at. Each spring, you're probably aware that we have an enormous breakup problem where the water for the watershed, water tends to pool up along Main Street in several spots. Also, I've noticed, and everyone has noticed, that when the water gets along the shoulders of the road, that pedestrians seem to walk out in the middle of the road, causing traffic hazards. Safety problems.
Debbie Gillespie Hudson has lived on Main Street for the past 5 years, and she's seen a lot of changes. And what do you think about all this, Deb?
Well, I think it's a bunch of garbage. They were taking away our front yard. My dog, we have to keep shortening the scene because the tourists keep coming closer and closer and closer. And the bird just keeps letting them walk right in the front door.
I've got Tom Rose here with me. Tom is the long-time owner of Denali Dry Goods, one of our great historic establishments here. Tom has been with us for 22 years. So, Tom, what do you make of this car?
Oh, I'd make a racetrack out of it. That's a big drag strip station on Main Street.
All right, we're going to get a kid's perspective. Here we got Crawford James, a young Mandingo fan here. He's just dying to grow up and play ball with the Mandingos. But, Jamie, I see you got the rollerblades on. How is this new pavement going to affect your life?
Well, you can rollerblade on it much more.
Is that why you're wearing the rollerblades?
Yeah.
Saturday, Jamie. You gotta have a little common sense and wear your knee pads. So the people of South Georgia have paved shoulders on Main Street. Some will see it as a positive development, while others will see it as an invitation to congestion. As I walked back past the Hudson House, I saw their dog, Bear, on his recently shortened chain, and he had this to say about where he thought things were headed in his town. Steve Bear, KTNA.
The nation's homeless usually bring to mind images of people sleeping on benches or huddling over grates. But Bering Straits Regional Housing Director Bruce Tavares wonders about the first graders in the state and where they'll live when they grow up.
For better or for worse, we've established 200 plus communities in this state. We have airports, we have clinics, we have schools, we have a lot of infrastructure building. We're putting in more water and sewer. Yet, you know, we really haven't answered the same question that you're asking about. What are we going to do? What can those first graders expect in 15 or 20 years in terms of what will be there in their village, which they consider now to be their home?
The answer might be a federal bill now in conference committee, which would give money directly to tribes. In Alaska, that means getting money to the regional housing authorities, which for the first time could prioritize and coordinate community needs. For example, if a village needed housing, a new well, and a sewage plant, the authority could take everything into account at once. Mark says it's all about planning.
But planning legislation does provide greater flexibility and we can do more. The question we worked on this legislation last year, and the question that was proposed by a well-meaning young Republican staffer was, well, if we give you this flexibility, how much money can we save? And our response was, no. The question is, if you give us this flexibility, how much more housing can we develop?
Coordinator for the state's housing authorities, Heather Arnett, says if that legislation passes, the flexibility will be apparent.
The money then could be used as different regions saw fit. If they felt like in their villages they needed to do a lot of housing improvements, they could do that. If they had more of a need for new construction, they could do that.
Arnett says housing authorities will have to be creative. And to do that, they'll need freedom to look for a variety of funding sources in the federal, state, and private sectors. Tavares says HUD has begun to loosen its control over the authorities already. The department is giving out smaller amounts of money along with greater responsibility. He says HUD is leaving behind its parental role. Gone are the Mother May I days when the regional agencies had to ask permission for everything. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
3, 2, 1. They come with names like blue mold and black leg, a mosaic of viruses that plague potato crops in Asia, Europe, and the lower 48. In the past 4 years, Alaskan farmers working with the university researchers have positioned themselves to help out and build an export market. University of Alaska plant pathologist Jennifer McCrest.
One of the natural resources we have in the state is our pristine Ivana. And then because of that Ivana, we could produce crops with a very minimum amount of diseases.
The state's remote location and cold winters have meant potatoes here are cleaner and healthier. It was Macbeth's idea to build a market for them in China and in her native Taiwan, where disease-free crops are highly sought after.
And so then we could produce a crop that was a high cash value, and which, of course, will offset the distance that we have to ship them.
She's developed a testing process and procedures for growing virus-free potatoes. For each of the past 3 years, the state's revolving loan program has put $100,000 into the project, and farmers have taken the risk in growing for a market that's not assured. Palmer grower Jay Dearborn says they're learning which varieties of potatoes will do well in both Asia and Alaska.
Now that we've basically proven that it's possible to grow potatoes that would meet the requirements and send them over there, the next step is to actually get some contracts of large enough quantities so that individual farmers will feel like it's not as risky a venture as it would have been 2 or 3 years ago.
The potential is to build markets anywhere the possibility for disease is high. The trick, Dearborn says, is to stay ahead. Farmers here are very aware that growers in Washington, Idaho, and Montana have their eye on what Alaska is doing.
We open the door to them, so to speak, and if we don't don't keep opening the door for ourselves on it, we may lose this opportunity.
Delta farmer Andy Andrews says the prospect of a steady market for Alaska's product is good and timely.
Right now, the farmers that are growing potatoes in Alaska, whether it be sweet potatoes or table use potatoes, have pretty well saturated the market. And that opens up another avenue to increase our production and increase agriculture in the state of Alaska.
The Chinese inspectors will be examining growing conditions at farms in Palmer, around Fairbanks, Isleton, and in Delta. They'll be in the state through the first week in September. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
No matter how many performers there are, they all wear masks. Each mask represents how spirits have appeared to salmon in their private life.
Ever since its release in 1988, the Drums of Winter has been snagging honors at festivals around the world. But filmmaker Leonard Kamerling and his colleague Sarah Elder say what makes the latest trio of awards so sweet is that they come from Native Americans. Kamerlin says in The Drums of Winter and their other films, he and Elder really follow the direction of village elders, a process they call community collaborative filmmaking.
In so many of the films that you see, many of the films that discuss that even explain culture. Our films, particularly The Drums of Winter, don't explain culture because of the collaborative process that we use and the access that that created. Our film goes into culture.
Beyond examining the link between music, culture, and spirituality, The Drums of Winter also reveals the Paul missionary's past over Native traditions. And as members of the Alaska Native Heritage Film Project, Kamerlin says he and Elder plan to create more films on Native culture in the future. For National Native News, I'm Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Fresh from last night's victory in the Republican primary, Senate District O candidate Gary Wilson is getting ready today for a fishing trip with his son. I'm Teresa Bacher. Wilson, a Fairbanks food wholesaler, beat his opponent Hal Hume by more than 400 votes. Wilson took 40% of the votes to Hume, 33%. As poll results were read off last night, Hume, a former police officer, expressed surprise at the numbers.
I thought that we had run probably the better campaign. I think that we had dealt with issues, my opponent had not dealt with issues, but that apparently was not the case. Obviously, the voters chose my opponent, and they must have been satisfied with the way he dealt with the issues.
Wilson says he doesn't have a plan yet for the general election race against Democratic candidate David Guttenberg.
We focused on hard-fought and a well-run primary, and we just spent very little time on the general election. We'll huddle up and start to work on that here shortly and have a strategy in the next week or two.
Guttenberg earned the least votes of the three candidates on the Senate District O primary ballot, racking up 27%. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
What we have here is an aircraft that had an in-flight failure of a wing, and we've not been able to determine the reason for the failure, but since we had this failure, it would behoove most of the pilots who own the airplane, if they haven't had it inspected in a while, to get the airplane inspected to preclude any possibility of a similar circumstance happening to them.
When I first sank, I remember it was on the weekend on a Friday. I was in a school bus, and I was very excited. I felt really special because the older folks staring out there would look at me and say, you're going to be very nice tonight. I was nervous, I was excited. I couldn't wait for the night to come.
Ever since its release in 1988, The Drums of Winter has been snagging honors at film festivals around the world. But filmmaker Leonard Kamerling and his colleague Sarah Elder say what makes the latest trio of awards so sweet is that they come from Native Americans. Kamerling says in The Drums of Winter and their other films, he and Elder really follow the direction of village elders, a process they call community collaborative filmmaking.
There's so many of the films that we see, many of the films that discuss or even explain culture, they attempt to explain culture. Our films, particularly The Drums of Winter, don't explain culture because of the collaborative process that we use and the access that that created. Our film goes into culture and attempts to look at culture from the inside.
1843, blow your bomb. No matter how many performers there are, they all wear masks. Each mask represents how spirits have appeared to Simon in their private life. The men occupy the benches. Some are without their powers, some are altogether naked.
Beyond examining the link between mythic music and spirituality, The Drums of Winter reveals the chilling effect Western missionaries had on Native culture. And her channeling this kind of disservice continues often enough when popular culture turns to Native themes.
One of the points of the festival was to compare what's being done today with films that were made in Hollywood over the last several decades. Which have a very particular point of view about Native people. And that point of view is nothing less than the meaning.
Kamerling says, as founders of the Alaska Native Heritage Film Project, he and Sarah Elder plan to continue their work documenting contemporary Native culture. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Henning.
In Calcutta?
I'll be there.
Fresh from last night's victory in the Republican primary, Senate District O candidate Gary Wilson is getting ready today for a fishing trip with his son. Wilson ran past opponent Hal Hume in yesterday's primary, taking 40% of the vote to Hume's 33%. Wilson says he doesn't have a plan yet for the upcoming race against Democratic candidate David Guttenberg.
He focused on a hard fought and a well-run primary, and he just spent very little time on the general election. We'll huddle up and start to work on that here shortly, and have a strategy in the next week or two.
Guttenberg earned the least votes of the three candidates on the Senate District O primary ballot, racking up 27%. In the race for the Republican Party's endorsement to represent House District 30, Bob Boko easily beat Judy Reid. More than 1,100 voters chose Boko, a former Fairbanks North Star Borough School Board member. He snagged just over 300 votes. Boko says his aggressive door-to-door campaign earned him the win, a strategy he'll continue during the days before the general election. Incumbent Tom Bryce got nearly 50% of the votes in that primary. In District 32, incumbent Al Veazey was the clear winner against fellow Republican Urban Rahoy. Veazey sailed away with 51% of the votes, while Rahoy attracted just 18%. Democrat Claudia Douglas received 516 votes, that's 31% of the total. She and Veazey will square off in November. Two Democrats competed for their party's banner in the race to represent House District 34. Bill Lewis beat John Steelbridge 16-17%. Both were distant finishers to Republican incumbent Jeanette James, who secured 77% of the vote. Finally, in District 36, three Republicans vied for the chance to face two-term incumbent Irene Nicolai this fall. Carl Morgan got the nod to represent the GOP with 27% of the vote. John Billings took 18%, and Frank Evans was a distant third with 7%. Nicolai stacked up more than 1,400 votes, nearly 50% of the total votes cast. 28.3% of the registered voters across the interior made it to the polls yesterday. That average just slightly better than the statewide rate of 27.9%. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bossard.
Mr. Lee, favorite content story. Students in the Western Interior guide to Adelaide School District are among the state's earliest back to school this fall, but not necessarily in the traditional sense. Dan Brown reports from the ground on a science camp which got a dozen district ninth graders away from the book and into the wild. 331. It's only about 10 minutes down the Texaco River by boat from McGrath to the Iditarod area school district's outdoor classroom. A cabin built last fall with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service grant funding as a place where students can learn amidst the nature that surrounds them in interior with Alaska.
I've always thought that Alaska was the science teacher's paradise.
McGrath School science teacher Nora Gallen is one of the camp's organizers.
This really accomplishes that. That objective of getting kids out in nature so they can really study the environment, do a lot of hands-on type learning activities that they wouldn't be able to do during the school year in the classroom.
Gollum and Inoko National Wildlife Refuge Biologist with Beverly Skinner have put together the two-week program during each of the last four summers, immersing secondary students in the environment most have grown up in, know little about, and are eager to understand. Learning and trying to obviously play equal parts in the camp experience as organizers balance the hard science for which students get high school credit with creativity and outdoor recreation. By bringing in local and outside experts, campers get a diverse 2 weeks, along with this year's kayaking and water chemistry,
Students also took a first grade class, built willow furniture, netted and studied invertebrates, created a food web diorama, learned about traditional and modern uses of local plants, and went fishing.
We actually did net when we go out and we say, and a deep change food. Brought me the anchor well into the bank and the third trip into that, which would grow food because went out and gave a good net and you just get them. And you get like, we got three pike the last time we did it, three sculpin and some whitefish suckers and salmon.
Science camp can offer so much thanks to continued Fish and Wildlife Service grant money and local in-kind support. The effort and dollars are well spent. The Anoka Refuge Skinner says the camp focuses on 9th and 10th graders as a possible first step toward a career in science.
For some people, this is their first high school science class, and it's fun. And they're finding out that it can be fun, that it isn't drudgery.
In the ground, I'm Dan Brown.
Land resource agent Michelle Adair says even if vines look bad, potatoes and other vegetables protected by layers of earth should be okay.
My potato vines have been hit pretty hard and they're very weak. But that doesn't mean that the potatoes in the ground are still swelling a little bit, taking moisture out of the damaged plant. And also, as we leave them underground this time of year, they'll go ahead and cure a little bit, so they'll have a thicker, tougher skin when we do pull them out.
Broccoli, cabbage, and cauliflower can take a light frost and will keep growing once it warms up. But not all crops are created equal. Adair says the frost probably damaged unprotected gardens.
The things that are most succulent and most sensitive to frost, you're going to find are dead. Things like tomatoes or nasturtium or lettuce. Because they have such thin cell walls, they're just going to burst and be kind of mushy.
Gardeners can extend the life of their veggies. Adair says putting a blanket or some other type of cover over crops at night protects them until the sun comes out. Temperatures around Fairbanks dipped below the freezing level to 28 degrees earlier this week. Folks in Beaver and Central shivered to the tune of 13 degree readings. Adair says gardeners always panic at the first frost. A late August frost isn't unusual, though. The UAF Cooperative Extension Program recommends preparing for a killing frost after the 30th. Forecaster Sharon Alden says the Labor Day weekend's weather might help put interior residents in a holiday mood.
No more frost in the forecast.
Cold Arctic air responsible for the frost is moving eastward and warm air from the south on the way. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
The board's 4-1 vote follows staff recommendations. In April, it decided to close federal public land to moose hunting a half mile from the Tyoosuke River. The decision affected all non-residents of District 21B and the villages of Fuquia and Ruby. Federal biologist Conrad Gunter says the board originally closed the area trying to preserve the land for subsistence hunting.
He found that local subsistence users were not having the opportunity to harvest as many moose as they could, and that the moose population is suffering as a result of it. He also, in ADF and G, felt that because of the moose harvest through that whole area, including the 3-2 area, that the bull cow ratio was down to some extent from what it had been in the past, and they felt that reducing the number of bulls harvested and increasing the cow harvest in that area would help to adjust that bull cow ratio. In a teleconference, the board staff told them federal regulations are actually more restrictive for subsistence hunters than the state guidelines and should be changed to go along with the state. Other testimony from state fishing game showed the moose population can support subsistence and non-subsistence hunting. Testimony from Galena and Mulatto supported fishing game's plan of a registration permit hunt and the earlier start of September 1st for subsistence hunting. The earlier hunt will allow locals a chance to get their moose without the heavy competition from trophy hunters that'll come later in September. In Galena, I'm Scott Campbell.
I'm ready. Give me your lead.
Okay. Here's the lead for the headline story. A headline outbreak at schools in McGrath and Chicago has students and parents scratching their heads. Gambrock report. 3-2-1. 10 McGrath school students are not in class this week because their parents don't want them to pick up headlines. Other kids have been sent home after what appeared to be like larva or eggs were detected in their hair or on their scalp during 3 weeks of screening for the human parasite. McGrath School Principal Karen Lattigard says this is the first lice outbreak in the 3 years since she's been principal, but that she's getting complaints from both sides. Parents upset about their kids being sent home, and those who think the lice epidemic proliferated because students with lice weren't dismissed early enough. Lattigard suspects lice found its way to the school from a summer camp, which many district kids attended in the nearby village of Takotna. Lattigard says students there have also been suffering.
It's a very high cost of parents calling the Santa Catoga on school and tell everyone about training. But I think, you know, the best way is asking, you know, families to clean your hair with the shampoo that kills the nits, which is the eggs. But the problem is that the kids with eggs, you know, continuing to come back to school and the eggs are hatching.
Anita Cruz is parent to a first, a fifth, and an eighth grader at the McGrath School. She says her kids will remain at home until Tuesday at the earliest, when the school plans another headlight screening.
I mean, it's just going to get to the school handled it. They know that last week that there are extra children, and they waited, I think, way too long to send their extra children home.
Cruz says she doesn't want headlights at home. Several McGrath families have been busy this week cleaning their homes to rid them of lice, larvae, and eggs. The McGrath Health Center has been providing screenings and handing out special shampoo and advice. Clinic Director of Physicians Assistant Brent Erfer says the itchiness of headlights is annoying, but not dangerous or uncommon in villages.
About once a year, we see a few cases. Anybody can get, you know, headlights. You know, you can take a bath, you know, every single day, wash your hair every single day, and you can still get headlights. So it has nothing to do with personal hygiene whatsoever.
Erfer says headlights will be used if people are conscientious. He predicts that if his recommendations for following shampoo directions explicitly, washing all clothing, towels, and bedding in hot water, and thorough vacuuming are adhered to, the lice problem will disappear. In McGrath, I'm Dan Brown.
As the population of rural Alaska continues to increase, governments on all levels are trying to reduce the threat posed by untreated sewage by building water and sewer plants. Charlie Walls, president of the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, says while state and federal governments are spending some $50 million on construction this year, he wonders how rural residents will foot the bill once the water is turned on.
Serious money on a statewide scale, but not one dime for operation maintenance. And to me, that seems really short-sighted because if you put in an expensive utility plant out there and you don't take care of it, properly maintain and operate it, and you just kidding yourself, it'll be a wreck in a few years.
Plans call for the residents themselves to pay the bill, which in many places will run about $150 a month. This directly concerns managers of Alaska's electric utilities, because the new water and sewer plants will require a lot more power. Rural residents have long relied on power cost equalization to offset high electric bills. Known as TCE, the program is set up to equally balance the subsidies for rural and urban Alaska. Where the rail belt receives hydro plants and enterprise, rural residents receive cash, roughly $17 million a year. 3 years ago, the legislature reworked TCE and funded it with a $67 million grant. Walls says it's still spending $17 million a year, and at this rate, the money will be gone in 3 more years.
These villages are getting squeezed as it is. Their income is getting cut back, as revenue sharing is reduced, and on the other side, these new bills showing up to run water and sewer plants and so forth. And then if the subsidy and that's cut, all of a sudden those electric bills triple.
Rural consumers currently pay roughly twice as much for electricity as the urban residents. If a customer now pays $80 a month for electricity without PCE, that could jump to $200. Add to that a $150 sewer bill, and at some point, says Cotterdale Electric manager Brad Reese, people may have to choose between electricity and running water.
I really think they're going to have a lot of serious problems with that. The economy is just not there. A lot of these people are just subsistence people. You go to their homes, they have turbo meat and rice and things that are stable, staple-type foods or whatever, but they don't have any real luxuries. They just can't afford it. And when you look at that sort of cost for them, I don't know where the income is going to come to pay for those systems.
He says managers are trying to adapt. Around Kotzebue, the electric co-op is looking at wind energy to offset diesel power. Others are looking at redesigning electrical generators. But alternatives don't come quickly, nor are they cheap. Rural co-op managers plan to make their plea more public and press the legislature for more money. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter. Three, two, one. There are plenty of fish in the river, but no one seems to want to buy them. The Department of Fish and Game has shut down much of the Yukon River to commercial fishing and increased subsistence fishing to 5 days a week. A scarcity of buyers prompted the department Thursday to close the area around Rampart for commercial fishing, and that follows a similar move made last weekend for areas encompassing Ruby and Galena. Fish and Game biologist Keith Schultz says the moves are market-driven.
There is a glut in the world market for chum salmon, but even the buyers that are participating in the fisheries are paying a pretty low price. Prices have ranged about 10 to 15 cents a pound for chum. And even the roe market is fairly depressed this year. Prices have been about $1.50 a pound for roe, and that's about half of what it was last year.
This at a time when more chum are making their way up the Yukon than biologists predicted. Schultz says the number of chum could approach 800,000, far more than the roughly 600,000 expected. One puzzle for biologists, though, is why, given the large Yukon run, more chum haven't turned up the Tanana. Schultz says it's still early in the Tanana run and more fish could be on the way. As it is, he expects commercial fishers could still harvest at the lower end of the guideline range, about 3,000 fish. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hanning. No one has any hard numbers, but the presence of snow machines and four-wheelers in Alaska's backcountry has dramatically increased in the last 5 years. A recent report to the Board of Game says in some areas of South Central and the Interior, recreational riding threatens some wildlife. Fish and Game's Palmer area biologist Herman Gasset says early season snow machines in places across the Mat Tree Borough is pushing moose out of their preferred high country habitat earlier than they should be.
It's critical to them to build up some reserves so they can make it to the winter, especially if a deep snow winter occurs. And if they're excluded from that high density browser area, they're forced to work harder to find the same amount at lower elevations.
The story says while moose become used to snow machines by springtime, in fall they're still wary of hunters and they'll make more effort to stay out of sight, drawing down their important fat reserves. Further, snow machine sales give an edge to an increase in wolf populations. Four-wheelers are also playing a larger role in those areas. Atlanta Polaris dealer Thumper Williamson says the price has dropped enough to make them affordable to more people.
Really open country for everybody. Downside is, there's a lot of hunters, but the upside is everybody can go. You don't have a plan to have a $50,000 tractor to go, you make $50,000 four-wheeler.
Officials say trails are hundreds of feet wide in some places and are extending farther than ever before. While this increases access to game, officials say they don't believe the trails cause much damage. The department does report increasing conflicts among hunters. So the study is quick to point out that much of the new impact is coming from recreational, not hunters, and that limits much of what the game board can do. The report concludes by suggesting a broader effort be made to educate snow machinists to understand that while they don't really affect habitat, the practices do affect wildlife. It also suggests some planning and land use designation would help ease pressure in sensitive habitat, but several factors make such planning difficult. The areas are controlled by a mosaic of federal, state, and private landowners. As for federal land, BLM planner KJ Nasova says while people supported planning on the Gulfana River, there's little public support for government involvement in Game Management Unit 13.
Frankly, we haven't pursued trails from Game Management Unit 13 with the same level of intensity, but we haven't gotten a sense yet that there's a lot of public support for BLM to study that area.
Can you say without the public behind the effort, there's little incentive to move forward? When people don't buy into the plan, they become lawbreakers, something no one wants more of. But UAF Resources Management Professor Alan Grubenville says the need to look forward increases as access improves, though typically Alaskans as a whole aren't very good at looking ahead.
Alaskans are just beginning to learn that, well, maybe we can't go and do everything we want to do, wherever we want to do it on the landscape, but it'll take a while like that.
In the meantime, Grubenville says, existing uses will expand. By the time people begin to support planning, the more likely include the uses that created problems in the first place. It's a difficult puzzle and growing more complex.
Without really a relatively good plan, we could destroy the very thing that we really wanted to enjoy in the long run. But once we destroy it, it may be too late to go back and recapture it.
Grubenville clearly supports planning and recommends it include the question of paving the Denali Highway. One factory says that would create a major impact. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Matilda Krista Huntington is an Alaskan native from the Yukon River Village with Kayakers. She graduated from the University of Washington as a physician's assistant and is going to practice her profession in the villages. One of Kahnemaw's first goals is to find native youth interested in pursuing healthcare professions and helping them. Matilda, though, is a family woman of middle years who worked for 5 years as a health aide before using her own resources to begin her PA training. She knows the value of bringing her new skills home to improve village healthcare.
First, I started out working in Kaikas as a health aide, and then I moved to Galena, where they needed another health aide, and then there were some physician assistants there that I was working with, and it seems like I was just about doing all the same things they were doing, but I was getting less pay. So I think money at first started to be a big factor, but in the end, it ended up to be just wanting to help people.
Matilda's accomplishment will add to the quality of village health care, and Galena Health Clinic Director Flora Speaker says it's important to the native community.
We've always had a turnover, a high turnover on our professional community, so it's very important. We did have several other ladies who were from our community also complete the medical program, and I'm now working in the healthcare system and in the urban communities that, you know, they did bring their expertise home for a while and then moved on. But it's, you know, it's very different now. The cost of recruiting and the continuity of care is most important.
There is one native doctor out of the 7 serving CCC sub-region, and according to Kahnemaw's chief, native patients are able to relate better because of the care background. CCC does have a scholarship program, as does Indian Health Services. In the past 4 years, though, Kahnemaw's chief says no native high school senior that they know of has gone on to enter health care training. To round out her training, Matilda will go to Fairbanks in October to take advanced trauma courses. She says if she's going to practice in the bush, she has to be prepared for anything. In Galena, I'm Scott Campbell.
The board, it wasn't brought to their attention that most of the antlers from new tents that occur in the state are drawn from their tents. And so since antlers moved are typically tents for food value and not turkey value, the board, through its delegation of authority to the commissioner, made an exception to that change that they had just implemented last spring, allowing the use of a proxy for antlers from new tents. The board received one comment from somebody who had put in for an at-risk new campaign that is set for 150 grant for turkey value. And when that was brought to the attention to the board, the board said, well, this is just, doesn't go along with the intent of why we passed this particular regulation change. So, since that regulation didn't go along with the intent, they went ahead and passed this emergency regulation.
Like any business, the Alaska Railroad is concerned with customer satisfaction. The train has been stopping in downtown Talkeetna since 1923, but spokesman Scott Banks says traffic jams and the need for easy access to the new Princess Hotel caused officials to look for a new site.
We want to know that the train is going to stop, and if anyone, the people that wanted to get in, look at the car. We also did it for so that if the tourists wanted to have the passengers get off, get in the bus there,
the railroad is a common carrier, which means managers are responsible for each passenger's safety when they get off the train. Another reason, Banks says, for the change. Banks says the railroad is a state-owned business, which can affect the decision-making process.
We're owned by the people, and so people tend to or want to be involved in some of the, you know, producer or decision-making process. But on the other hand, we are charged by the legislation that created us to be self-supporting and to act as a business and to try and promote commerce within the scope. And we keep all of those factors in mind, and it's a fine balancing act for us.
Railroad managers say the company can only afford one stop in the Talkeetna vicinity. Since employees can only work 12-hour shifts by law, more stops would cost more money. And that's an expense the railroad isn't willing to cover. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Industry watchdog Richard Feinberg spent 9 months researching documents and interviewing employees. He says after 20 years of operation, the pipeline's wearing out, and its operators aren't doing enough to ensure safety.
My conclusion is that the pipeline is at serious risk of a major spill or fire or explosion. The risk comes from the simple fact of an aging pipeline, and our risk is predilection for cost cutting, for reducing costs, may not have things under control to the degree that its management believes it does.
Feinberg prepared a report for the Alaska Forum, a watchdog group that aims to hold government and industry responsible. In more than 300 pages, he details problems with malfunctioning gate valves, a leaky vapor recovery system, bad communications, and continuing electrical problems. He says in spite of company efforts to listen to whistleblowers, employees still don't feel safe when raising safety issues. He says many of the problems to Alaska's efforts at cutting costs by closing pump stations, cutting staff, and delaying maintenance.
We are spending money, we're not spending it sufficiently, and at the same time, Alaska is trying to save money. There's a contradiction there. And so we are spending money, but probably not spending sufficiently or in the correct way.
Feinberg argues that after more than a decade of relatively smooth operation, the last 3 years have seen an increase in number of serious incidents, including problems restarting the pipeline after maintenance shutdown. He says during a restart last year, sudden pressure changes slammed a check valve so hard it damaged the tenant's booster line and ripped some valve parts out of the mounting. And a restart 4 months ago, he says a pump overheated, the seal failed, releasing oil and black smoke, leaving fears of an explosion. Feinberg says Alyosha wasn't prepared for the situation and that its quality control program is inadequate. The Alaska Forum requested the audit to challenge audits by the General Accounting Office and other government agencies. It says those audits paint a reassuring picture, but it's one that some current employees say misses the truth. Alaska spokesperson Jennifer Rye says the company appreciates Feinberg's concerns, but stands by the earlier audit.
The GAO audit 1995 said that there were no safety concerns and that we were to stay the course and continue fixing the things that we'd identified in the course of the BLM audit and the TAP assessment, which was the audit done by the owner companies. So you know, the pipeline is safe, and we're going to continue to be safe and go down this track that we have towards operational excellence.
Morris says while the company may have failed to meet some of its goals, it has implemented an employee concerns program so workers can raise issues without fear of retaliation. But changing corporate culture, she says, takes time.
Especially when you're talking about issues like culture change, I mean, that is a significant process to put in place. So that all is part of this, you know, give us some time because we're fixing what we believe needs to be fixed, and we're fixing what the state and federal government have asked us to fix.
Sundberg's also critical of state and federal regulators, and among other things, the Joint Pipeline Office appears too reliant on Alyosha. JPO spokeswoman says they've received the report, and while open to criticism, officials have found nothing in it that they aren't already working to resolve. Finally, Feinberg offers 10 recommendations for strengthening and funding oversight agencies, as well as increasing record keeping. The group is asking to meet with the governor, hoping he'll join them in the push for further reform. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
CIAA is trying to improve the lives of people with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, and this grant aims to get them off the streets. Since it comes from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the housing must meet adequate and safe standards. The Client Services Director, Allison Ellis, says the grant is flexible.
By those standards, a cabin out in the woods without running water doesn't meet HUD's housing quality standards. So people have a choice. They can move into the city and live in an apartment. They can subsidize their rent. If that's not an option for them, they really enjoy their life out in their cabin. That's their property and their place. Then other ways we can help them is we can help them with their rent, but we can help them meet some other needs. We can help them meet some medical needs, pick up a doctor's bill here and there, help them maybe with some nutritional needs and those kind of ways. So they're still receiving services and in a place where they
Ellis says the grant is also flexible enough to help people without asking them to change their habits. For instance, IV drug users won't be required to get clean before getting assistance. Ellis says once a client has a safe place to live, they may be more likely to deal with their other problems. Anyone with HIV and a low income can get vouchers for housing, food, and medicine. For example, a single person who makes less than $27,000 a year would get some sort of aid. And Alice says clients don't have to sacrifice anonymity to get it.
Just because you come in and ask for this money and get these services does not mean that you have to reveal your HIV positive status to the community. If you come in, the IAA family, the chief manager, will know your HIV positive status. So it doesn't mean that you move into an apartment, your neighbor's going to know, your landlord is going to know. So we want people to know that they can get these services confidentially.
Getting people off the street helps ensure that they can meet their other needs for staying healthy, and that reduces demands on available hospital services and shelters in the community. So by providing housing, Ellis says the IAA hopes to begin building steps for a person to live independently. In Fairbanks, I'm Chris Sabatka.
With a new mandate to get more people into the workforce, we're going to be seeing a lot more people that are looking for this kind of assistance. There will be some federal dollars coming through, but probably not enough to match the increased demand. So I think we're going to see real pressure on the program. Most of the families that we work with now do not use welfare in any way, and this is the only assistance program that they use. They use it so they can stay away from welfare and food stamps and all those other things so that they can support themselves with just this little bit of economic assistance for the childcare piece because it is so expensive.
The EAF power plant burns over 200 tons of coal every winter's day, and that means a truckload of coal ash that gets hauled to a landfill. But there is a use for that trash. University Ready Mix of Fairbanks has been turning coal ash into concrete for the past 3 years. Owner Larry Horner says the waste ash from an area power plant can be mixed in with cement and used in a variety of building capacities, from foundations to walls. He says his company wouldn't use ash from outside the state.
The price, if you had specifically, something like that, and the cost be prohibitive. And, you know, right now we can buy it from here, and it's up to the state, but Yeah, it definitely landed. A lot of competitors and I have not used it in the past because it is expensive to get involved in it. You have to new storage facilities and hogs and such, and you have to put an investment in some daily uses.
The investment may be worth it. Horner says ash can be used as up to 15% of the concrete mix for half the price of cement, which isn't produced in this state. But coal ash is an abundant resource here. UAF Civil Engineering Department Head Lucy Rod says Alaska's coal-burning power plants produce about 200 tons of coal ash each day. Rod says his research team hopes to document ways to use the lower grades of coal ash with another grant from the Science and Technology Fund.
You can use ash, which is not such ash, to control density. I mean, this, for example, this kind of application is using washing extensively, and it involves a huge volume, large volume of ash, depending on the application, and it provides you with cells that are very uniform densities, which is, which many times, you know, because of the nature of the stuff, it's very difficult to control. You know, you cannot monitor very well, or you cannot place very well. It acts very nicely, it has a lot of air in it.
Rod says the first ash project produced immediate results, and that's something they'd like to repeat in the next phase.
We would like to really get the power plants more involved because they are the producers. And one of the things that we would like to address is the possibility of investing and purchasing new equipment or improved equipment for collecting ash so that we get the higher quality ash. We can extract most of it and use it rather than letting them go and dumping it.
Rod says his research team focused on using coal ash from the Healy power plant because one of the members owns an engineering materials company there. David Evans now sells Healy's ash to contractors. He says the pulverized coal used at Healy produces a finer ash, making it the highest grade available in the state. Evans says other power plants may be forced to upgrade their waste ash.
They're tipping too expensive when they have to go to a landfill, like the Borough landfill or something like that. I mean, they're at $50 a ton now. As that goes up, it may become too expensive for anyone to refuge in those areas. And always be looking for other locations to fulfill those.
Using coal ash as a construction component isn't anything new. It's been a standard in the lower 48 for most of the century. But it is a relatively new development in Alaska because no one knew what grade of ash could be used reliably in this severe climate. And Rod says since most of the ash produced here is usable in one form or another, it makes sense to fund projects that find a market for what would otherwise be another solid waste taking up landfill space. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.